Hello, and welcome back to The Calling. I'm Andrew Boyer, and Reverend Merrick Zabriskie is not here with us. He's in Cuba, and so we're actually here with Reverend Terry Ellsberg, so welcome. And this week, we are very excited. This is the podcast I've been most excited to do. We're here with Jim Johnston, and you have heard his work if you're a regular listener, because that introductory song was written by Jim. And Jim is a American composer and musician, and he's best known for his relationship with World Wrestling Entertainment. And so this will be a podcast, a church podcast, probably different than one you've ever heard before. We're going to listen to some of his music. We're going to talk a little bit about his background. He has written over 10,000 pieces. He's collaborated with hip-hop artists and rock artists like Motorhead, Disturbed, Kid Rock, Ice-T, Run DMC. So we're hoping this will be a very interesting and illuminating interview. And Jim, welcome to The Calling.
Thank you. Boy, hardly sounds like something happening at a church, does it?
This is probably a little different than what we normally hear at Christ Church. And also, I should warn our listeners, I guess, that some of the music that we're going to hear is not as liturgical as some that you've probably heard before.
And in keeping with this podcast, it was to me.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I think that's a great point. And so maybe tell us, like, as a young man, how did you get started with music? What instruments did you play? How did you get involved?
Well, I'm old enough that when I was in grade school, they made you play an instrument. They gave you one, and you were in the band. And I got trumpet. I have no recollection of ever choosing trumpet, of my parents saying, like, well, we'd like you to play trumpet. I just knew that suddenly I was taking trumpet lessons in third grade, they started us. After that, the next stop was piano lessons, sort of obligatory. If you're going to be a good parent back in those days, you give your kid piano lessons. That lasted for a year before I convinced them to, this was the worst thing in the universe, and please let me stop. Then I rented a guitar, basically in line with the Beatles coming out. Very inspirational for me. So learned guitar, and I would go through the Beatles records with my crummy little, one of those suitcase record players. I'd slow them down and try to figure out what they were playing, and I taught myself to play guitar by learning all their songs. Then I would learn the bass guitar parts on the low four strings of the guitar. And then later, when Paul McCartney started to play piano on his songs, then I was back to piano, and I taught myself piano and then drums. I just sort of went through the band and taught myself all these things.
And you, how many instruments now do you play?
I play a lot of instruments. I don't play the string instrument, you know, violins and cellos. That's a lifetime in and of itself. Once you learn one horn, you can scramble through the other horns. But I really don't play much anymore except piano and guitar, because sampling, well, we might have to talk about what sampling is, but computer-driven composing has progressed so extraordinarily that you can do a lot of it on computer.
And what was the first song you ever composed?
Oh, that's a good thing. I guess in high school, I started composing little ditties with dumb, bad things that no one should hear, that I did with a friend, Jeff McGuire, who was one of my closest friends in high school, and then we ended up going to college together as well. He went on to get nominated for an Academy Award for writing In the Line of Fire screenplay, the Clint Eastwood film. He would mainly do lyrics. I mainly did music. And we just wrote songs about a teacher we didn't like, anything, mm-hmm. any dumb stuff.
One of the things that we talked about, and it's kind of come up in conversations, is that you're not a classically trained composer, despite the fact that you've written over 10,000 pieces. And tell me a little bit about that. For a non-music person, I don't really know what the difference is. And can you tell the difference between a classically trained composer and a non-classically trained?
Boy, I'm going to get myself into trouble here. But generally, yes, because ear musicians generally play looser and with more feel and a little more emotion. Classically trained players, they're trained to follow what's on the paper. And even if there's a wrong note on the paper, there's at best a 50-50 chance that they'll raise their hand and say, like, wow, I have a really weird note here. Is that really what you want? Most of the time I've been conducting an orchestra, had an obviously horrible note happening somewhere in the orchestra. Everyone says, I'm fine. Then I finally found it. It was in violas, I think. And they said, well, it's B flat on the page. So that's what we play. It's a whole different thing. I just got lucky enough to, blessed enough to just be able to hear. I can hear, and if I'm at a piano and you play a song for me, I'll be able to figure out the chords in 20 seconds.
Well, Reverend Ellsberg and I were talking in the hall, and we sort of said that of all things to feel like there's divinity, probably music is the most... is the thing that seems to be sort of the most divinely inspired and also seems to resonate with people the most. Like,
Well, some of them, I don't want to jump too quickly into the God part of this conversation, but some of them are clearly just a gift handed down, because I've had experiences where I will sit down and I will play something, and it is like that little rough. I always use my phone to record things because I'll forget them when I have an idea. I've had times when that demo is 98% what the final song is. It's like I knew it and I'm just playing it for the 50th time. And it's just arrived. I don't know how much time we have today, but I can tell you another interesting story if you want.
Go
along
ahead.
Those lines. When I was at WWE, our executive producer came to me and handed me a videotape, a vignette storyline videotape, about a 2-3 minute little film, and basically explained the producers had put all sorts of different types of music to it, trying to make it work. And he was like, I've got a political mess on my hands. Would you just try something? I think basically the video is so bad that it's not saveable. But I've got to be able to tell this producer that I went to you, I tried everything I could to make it work. I watched it, worst thing I've ever seen. Sat down, when I'm scoring to picture like that, I have a general orchestral sounding patch, and I'll just play along and let whatever happens, happens. Halfway through it, I was crying like a child. I don't know how that happens, but I've had it happen numerous times, and it take your breath away. Takes my breath away. My breath away thinking about it now.
Well, I mean, for sure, all of the songs, I kind of went through some of your songs on YouTube, and you could even see in the comments that people, it brought back their memories. It made them feel young again. It's such a powerful
it's amazing,
force.
It can take you back to a moment in your life.
Speaking of a moment in your life, when was sort of the point where you said, hey, this is my calling, this is what I'm going to be?
I guess I knew it early on, but at the end of college, with help of one of my professors, because I was studying commercial design and architecture, he said, you should go to Harvard's architectural school, and actually got me in. And I thought, wow, you know, who's going to turn that offer down? And it got to the last minute, and I went to my dad, and I said, I can't do this. I got to try the music thing, which he thought was, of course, insanity. I thought it was insanity, to turn it down. But I just knew I got to try this thing.
And so originally you were doing scores for movies and that sort of thing?
Originally I was doing absolutely nothing, and you just try to meet anyone who might need music. And basically you're lying through your teeth because you're trying to make it sound like you've done something with your life and you've done nothing. You know, what have you done? I scored a short thing for a friend of mine, and, you know, which was marginally true. There was some truth to it. And you get a little job, and then you parlay that into another little job, and then suddenly you've got a crummy little reel that almost looks professional. But the first things of note I was doing, I did a lot of stuff for the cable networks at that time, which were just blowing up, HBO and MTV. And so I did a lot of work for them.
And then probably you met Vince McMahon and your whole life changed?
Well, I had sushi. I have never been a pro wrestling fan. I'm not one now. I was a sushi fanatic. There was only one sushi bar in town at that time with six seats. So it was like going to a local bar where you'd see the exact same six to eight people every time you went there. Guy walks in one night that we'd sort of recognized each other. And he said, "Didn't you say you were a musician?" He said, I've got to do a videotape. I can do the videotape, but I have no idea how to put music to it. And I said, sure, do that all the time. Never done it in my life. He was WWE's art director, and through that went to Vince McMahon to play the thing, and Vince said, "Wow, great!" And then from there,
did wrestlers, and you probably know more about the history of wrestling than I do, but did they used to always, did they have their own theme music, or were you kind of one of the first to sort of associate?
No, I was the first one to do entrance themes, or what's now called walk-up music, I think, or walk-on music. Yeah, no, it was an amazingly stupid business. Two guys would walk down a ramp to a ring. They'd pretend to fight,
right?
Yell at each other. They'd leave. Two more guys would walk in. No music, nothing.
But what's sort of incredible is what you more or less invented. Mm. I was kind of thinking about it as it's kind of portraiture with music. You're essentially drawing out whatever you think, almost like abstract portraiture. You're drawing out whatever abstract qualities these individuals you think have, and then trying to make music.
Always saw it as live film scoring.
Uh-huh.
Almost going back to silent pictures, where the organist would just watch the movie and play the emotion that he saw on the screen. It's branding.
Yeah.
That's what it really is how to brand these characters, how to brand a program.
Well, so I thought it would be interesting, and this is where we're going to take a left turn from most church podcasts to play some of your music.
Buckle
and you
up.
Can tell us a little bit about what you were trying to convey and what it means. Okay. Let's start with this one.
What the Rock is cooking.
So that's Dwayne Johnson, now the biggest movie star in the world. He was actually relatively difficult to do because he's an interesting guy. He's not black. He's not white. He's not Puerto Rican. He's not a big meathead, who comes out. He's incredibly clever. He's the most charismatic guy I've ever met in my life.
He
truly is electric.
Did you know that he was going to be
what he turned out? No. Yeah. Well, after a short while, yes. But when he first showed up, no.
Because you called that, wasn't that the electrifying, it's in the, it was in the title. Yeah.
Yeah. The most electric. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, let's do another one.
Okay. Okay, that's Mick Foley, known as Mankind. He is a really interesting guy, and there's a lot of stigma against pro wrestling, and I'm one of the people who probably promotes it. But there are a lot of interesting people, just like Hollywood is an equally strange place, but there are some really interesting people out there. He is incredibly smart. He speaks like five or six languages. Incredibly nice guy. Family guy. Incredibly gracious. Just a nice man. But if you saw him on screen and working, you'd think, that's a wrestler.
Yeah.
You know?
No, well, I remember he wrote a book that I think was pretty well reviewed, where people said, wow, this guy actually is a really good writer. He didn't even ghostwrite it.
Mm.
But his character was sort of this like escape from a mental asylum or something, right? But yes. He came off, he completely played a character. So did you, when you came up with that song, did you kind of go with his character, I assume?
Yes, as in any scoring situation, you want the music to reflect either the character or the storyline to get people emotionally into that story or into that character. Uh-huh. And with Mankind, I wanted something that was deep and dark and a little bit complex, I guess.
All right, let's go to this one.
Oh. That's Undertaker, which is probably the most famous, infamous thing I wrote while there, and largely because of Undertaker. He had this very mystical vibe and, dare I say, right on the edge of religious.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he had this finishing move where he'd drop to his knee and hold his hand up, and people just loved it. But someday my goal is to stuff Jamie in a bag and put him in the back room and play it on the church organ in there, only because I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a beautiful, somber piece, almost like a funeral dirge.
Yeah. And, well, he's supposed to be a dead guy.
Right. But it's amazing that a group of wrestling fans want to be sort of pumped up with loud rock music or rap music, but you kind of go with something that's really quite somber, and it even has a greater emotional effect.
I think all people love to be entertained, and how people get entertained is to somehow stir their emotions. And loud rock music is just one way, and that audience is no different than any other, that they love sentimentality, and Undertaker's thing has really worked.
Okay.
Still works.
This is our last wrestling song.
Okay. All right. Infamous Steve Austin, the Rattlesnake, another incredibly nice guy, was always very gracious to me. Going back to the Beatles song, Act Naturally, the people who succeed in that business, just like I believe the people who succeed in Hollywood, they have a gift for finding that character within themselves, or the other way around. I don't know, finding themselves in that character. So they don't put themselves in the position of having to act. They are just a slight modification of who they are. You know, I mean, take someone who, Julia Roberts. All of her parts, you kind of feel like you're seeing Julia Roberts. You know, it's, and I think it's because she just lets herself shine through those parts.
So let me turn that back to you then. So is there a Jim Johnston sound that like that you shine through on?
I think my best stuff is this is going to sound a little weird, is sad stuff, very darker, very emotional stuff.
Uh-huh.
I have a theory that probably any psychologist will come slap me or something, but it seems to be true to me, is that artists who are troubled, maybe not artists, let me leave it to musicians, tend to write happy, hopeful stuff. James Taylor lived a pretty tough life, you know, a lot of addiction, a lot of problems, horrible family scenario. But his songs are almost universally hopeful and happy. And people who are fundamentally happy, which, thank you, God, I put myself in that category, seem to be much more comfortable exploring the darker side of things and observing people's going through depression and what that means and what's the pain in the heart that is caused by those things, and trying to write stuff that I believe that music is healing. So I frequently feel when I've written a piece of music that I hope someone who's hurting in a certain way hears this because they think it might help.
That's really interesting. So tell me about what you're doing now with music.
Oh, well, post-WWE was so freeing because I, after so many years of not being told what to write, but being in a certain ballpark, shall we say, I could go to my studio and do whatever I wanted. And it had been a long time to do that. So I would say most of my work has been orchestral, which is not, I'd say half my work at WWE was orchestral. Most people hear that or meet me, ask me what I did. They immediately assume I did heavy metal music all the time, which was so far from the truth.
Actually, I was wondering about that. Did you, you know, you do seem to have a lot of influences. Like, did you listen to heavy metal and stuff like that?
Never.
No.
Never.
Because you do it really well. Like,
well, thank you,
like
but
you
it's,
come to it. Yeah.
It's, I never liked heavy metal music, never listened to those bands. I liked songs that said something.
So here's a song that you've been working on relatively recently, and let's listen to a little of it. It's quite different.
I will go walk the old steeple road, down where it ends at the edge of the sea.
So that's quite moving. Tell me about that song.
So I think that's that probably falls in what I was saying before about a healing song. I think if someone with a broken heart listened to that song, it would send some sort of message that you're not alone, you're not the first one to have gone through this. And, you know, I know you're waiting for things to turn around, but they will.
And do you write the lyrics as well as the music?
I do.
Yeah. Because that sounded to me like it's a religious song. It sounds like, I thought that that was a he with a capital H, but is that not the case? Or
yeah, it's so interesting. You're the first one who has ever noticed that. Not about that song, but just in general, because so many things I've written over the years, I look at it after I've written it, and I go like, oh my God, what were you thinking about when you wrote this thing? It's kind of trance-like when you're writing it. It's sort of hard to explain. And I think about it now, and I realize it's trance-like because I think about sitting with either with guitar or piano, whatever I'm writing it on, and you're just trying to imagine what it is and where is it? It's going. What's this? I mean, with this, it started out. Or I remember is I just thought about sort of the incredibly contemplative nature of standing on a beach, and that there's this aspect to beaches that people look out on the water, and I don't think they're really thinking it, but it seems that they're thinking they're waiting for something. Yeah, you know, whether the tide is coming in or whatever metaphor you want to put on it, go down the list. You know, will love come my way? Will God show up in my life? Will I win the lottery? You know, I mean, whatever it is that's on people's mind at the time.
Yeah, there's something about looking at the ocean and feeling very small and very one with, you know, the world at the same time. Mm. Let me do one last song, and then I've completely monopolized this podcast, Reverend Ellsberg, so we'll go to you next. One second.
Well, that's an orchestral piece that, in the spirit of what I just said about it, I often don't see things until after the fact, that you would ask me to send over a couple of recent things. The name of that song is Grace, or that instrumental, that orchestral piece. First of all, I love movie soundtracks. I love the power of music to picture, how moving, transformative, really, it can be. And in that piece, I was thinking about how joy and sadness can be so intertwined in the same second and can be overwhelming. Wow. I hope I'm not going out of school here and you can edit this out, but I know you just recently lost your dad. And I think that's one of those times is your system can get overwhelmed with how sad I am to lose this person and how incredibly lucky I was to have the time I had with them. So it's these two 180-degree emotions happening instantaneously. And when I just did the simple piano version when I was writing that, it just felt like that. It was joyous and it was incredibly sad. And I love that. And I think that's a perfect time to bring my friend Terry in, who I'm so grateful for you to be here today. Because you must speak to people frequently who are experiencing one of those extremes. Probably, sadly, more the sad part. But
yes, I do. And that's an incredibly beautiful melody, by the way, Jim.
Thank you.
You know, my whole life is being with people in the most, say, the most tender moments of their lives. I'm with families who, with people who are dying, holding their hands sometimes, with families who have lost a loved one. I'm meeting with brides and grooms at the Glory Days Diner, right. My home away from home over here in the Post Road, and planning their wedding and also doing what I call premarital counseling, which is talking to them about marriage. Doing weddings is the happiest thing I do because it's all new beginning. It's all about love. It's all about hope. It's all about joy. And then I'm with families, you know, baptizing little babies. It's the most privileged life I think a person can have is to be a minister, Episcopal priest like I am, because I'm there in these high moments, often great joy and often great sadness. How do I do it? The only way I do it is with God's help. I could never do it by myself. That's why you say a minister is called. When you're called, that means you're called by God to do this particular thing. Whenever I hear a clergy person saying, well, I decided I was going to go to seminary. Somebody said to me, Terry, when did you decide? I didn't decide to go. I was called. I argued. I was like Moses. He didn't want to go off and deliver the children of Israel because it's too big a responsibility. I argued with God like Moses. And every time I'd say, God, show me another miracle, he always did it, you know, to prove that I was supposed to go. And once you're called, then he gives you grace, that word, that unmerited favor, the help of the Holy Spirit to help you handle these sad things and be there for people, things you can never do on your own.
There's a similar thing in composing that I experience. I don't know if others do. My relationship with God, that I feel like if I'll do my part, if I'll sit down at the piano, if I'll pick up a guitar and play, that he'll send something. And he has 100% of the time.
It's like me with preaching.
I have never sat down and not had an idea. Never.
Somebody said to me once, Terry, do you like to preach? And I said, it's the most terrifying thing I do. I said, why do you say that? Because who do I think I am to climb into that pulpit and presumably be speaking the word of God? But that's what I pray for. God, give me the words. And he's never let me get up there wordless yet. Because people don't need to hear Terry. They need to hear from what God is saying in the moment.
Well, people do need to hear from Terry, but
I hope
I get your point.
But hopefully I'm doing it because God's given me the words.
Mm. Well, we've gone a little long, and this podcast was everything I hoped it would be. That was just terrific for both of you.
Right.
I'll
go another 2 hours with you two.
I thank you so much for everything that you've contributed to this podcast, as well as personal advice. You've given me a lot of advice as well, and I think we all appreciate it. If anyone wanted to listen more to your work and the work that you're most proud of, how would they do that?
Well, if you happen to be a WWE fan, you can find
they already it. Love you.
You find you find it all over the internet. But and sorry, one last point I'll throw in is not being a wrestling fan. What kept me there all those years was a feeling that I was bringing joy to all these fans who I knew, who let me know they really loved the music. And that made the difference for me because it was a reason. I'm redesigning my website, which should be back up and running in hopefully a week or so. And there'll be all my new favorite music on that. And continuing new music that I'm coming.
And
up
would
with.
You ever perform, or you don't like to perform?
I have wicked stage fright. Yeah. I have difficulty playing a new song for my wife, a hymn and a haw. I'm serious. She will attest to this. I don't know where it came from, but it just terrifies me.
We should do this tiny desk, the Christchurch tiny desk concert. You know, we'll broadcast it. Thank you, Jim Johnston. Thank you, Reverend Terry Ellsberg, for joining us on The Calling, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.